Moncrief on News Talk.
When the journalist Katie Glass was born, her mother was 24, but her father was 62. When he entered his 80s, Katie was still in her teens. And for many years, her reaction to this age gap was to keep quiet about it, an attitude that has adjusted over time, particularly after his death. Katie's been writing about all of this in the Sunday Times. Katie, good afternoon.
Afternoon, nice to speak to you.
Now, as I understand, your parents divorced when you were very young. You're only about two. So after that, how often would you see your father?
Right, well, so they had quite a difficult divorce. So I saw him sort of rarely, maybe once, twice a year or something. But then when I became a teenager, I was able to see him much more. But as you said, so there had been this huge age gap between my parents, 40 years, of which my mum was very ashamed, and sort of instilled in me the idea that having this very much older father was a very shameful thing. So even though, yes, later on I would go and see him, as I sort of wrote in my piece, I never told any of my friends about him. I was so ashamed of this idea that I had this very, very old father. So yeah, as I got older, I did go and see him more, but never took any friends to go and meet him or anything.
Oh my God, my word. And so like when he died then, in your peer group, did people even at that stage didn't know that what his age was?
Yeah, so I mean, I was quite young when he died. I was still in my 20s. I decided to write this piece about him because I think I'd been so ashamed of him when he was alive. And this idea of having the older father was just such a sort of shameful thing to me. I don't know why. I suppose the age difference. And I mean, he's a generation of my grandparents. That's, you know, how much older he sort of was than me. But when he died, very sadly, in my 20s, because none of my friends had ever met him, I realized, I think part of the grief was I didn't have anyone to sort of share those memories with. And over time, you start to realize what a terrible shame that is. And more, just actually, it was quite extraordinary to have had this experience of growing up with, you know, someone in my life who, like I say, was my grandparents, would have been, you know, the equivalent of my friend's grandparents' age.
But he sounds like a real character, though. Some of the claims he made, did you believe them all? That he saw Edith Piaf sing or he personally knew Dale Carnegie?
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinary. So being a journalist, you know, over time, I've sort of like gone back and experienced, looked into some of the things that he claimed. I mean, because of this huge age difference, for example, his parents had come to England in the 1890s. So he was born in 1919. His parents had come to England in the 1890s from Lithuania. I know that's true because I went on a mission off to Lithuania and managed to find the details of them arriving. And he had told me these things when I was growing up that seemed like crazy stories. I mean, look, when I was little, I didn't even know who he was on about when he said, I saw Edith Piaf sing once. And he described arriving somewhere as a young man and someone ushering him in saying, look, you can see this performance, and him sitting down and later realizing who it was. And it did seem like an absurd claim to me. And as I was writing this piece, you know, I was conscious it was going in the Sunday Times. I thought, I'll check these dates. And I mean, he was only 4 years older than her. So perhaps not more inconceivable than me watching like Fontaine's DC or something. So he emigrated as a teenager to South Africa. And the year he emigrated, there was the huge British Empire exhibition. So this was this huge exhibition that went round in the sort of 1900s, showcasing all the sort of amazing things that were happening around the empire. So I know that was true because I went to South Africa and found out about the history of that exhibition. And another thing he claimed, so later on in life, he did move to America. When I was living with him and I was a little kid, we were still living in America. He always claimed to have been taught by Dale Carnegie. So again, that seems like insane to me. But, you know, certainly a man of his time. I mean, he was there in the 50s, How to Win Friends and Influence People, the famous Dale Carnegie book came out in 1936. So I think it was possible. I mean, it's strange, isn't it? Because these seem so, part of me is like, they seem sort of inconceivable. But then, like I say, they're only sort of famous people of his time, in the same way I would tell people perhaps I had some experiences in my time.
Yeah. Now, you did mention that your grandparents had to leave Lithuania. Now, that was to escape pogroms, because obviously they were Jewish. Did your father speak about that kind of thing much? Or because, you know, he would have been of that generation, I suppose, that would have just brushed over hardship or not mentioned it at all.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I realised, you know, when I started to sort of feel more positively or at least more interested in this idea I'd had this much older father, you know, partly it was that he'd had this crazy history of experiencing things that, yeah, were like sort of two generations away from me. And also he was so different exactly to my friend's dad's. I mean, he was a sort of grandparents generation. So he would absolutely never spoke about anything about how he felt or anything that had been difficult. He'd lost his mum when he was very young. When he was about three, she had died. I remember trying to ask him once about it, and he just said something like, I can't really remember. And then, you know, as I got older and was a teenager, so I didn't grow up Jewish because it goes through your mother, but I sort of understood he had been Jewish. And I said, gosh, you know, you lived through the Second World War as a Jewish man. Your parents had left Lithuania during the pogroms. You know, what must that have been like? And he'd sort of say, oh, you know, he had a private pilot's license. He said, oh, I was just flying a lot. And that was sort of end of conversation. But, you know, I think it's funny. I mean, I sort of write in my piece that, see, he very much in that way had the attitudes of his time. He was very emotionally unavailable. He was quite sexist, really. And I think I put that down, you know, obviously not everyone of his generation. He'd be 107 if he was alive now. No, obviously not everyone of that age is sexist. But, you know, there were certain attitudes he had about women. He was quite shocked about the idea I was sort of like working, and later quite proud of it. And actually said to me, you know, that I'd really changed his idea about whether women should work. He had this idea, I think, really of women as sort of accessories to men. So it was strange growing up with these very different tastes. You know, he was always listening to Frank Sinatra. His tastes, were very old-fashioned and Shirley Bassey. He drove a Bentley. The sort of things we'd do together. You know, he would take me for dinner at the Ritz, where they had a menu, the ladies' menu, didn't have prices on for women. So in some ways, I guess, I know, it's insane.
You'd be bothering your dizzy little head with the paying for stuff,
quite, you know, one wouldn't have the money to pay for stuff. So not for ladies to be troubled about the cost of things. So in some ways, I think, you know, that's obviously absurd, but maybe quite sweet, really, to have had a taste of, I guess, a very different generational attitude. Because as well as, I guess, a certain perhaps objectifying of women, at the same time there was a lot of caring for women as part of that. Do you know what I mean? So it was a different attitude. I was really trying to write about how there were pros and cons to the way he was.
A very meaningful generation gap there, certainly attitudinally. Do you think you had something of an effect upon him, though, at the same time?
I think we used to sort of observe each other and be sort of a bit intrigued about the other one being so different. He would very sweetly sometimes come and do things with me that I was interested in doing as a teenager, take me to places like the Trocadero Center. I mean, he would have been in his 70s when we were doing stuff like that. And then, like I say, you know, he'd be playing me Frank Sinatra records, and I'd be thinking, you know, sort of what are we listening to? And we would sometimes argue about stuff. I remember him saying, you know, he thought it was my brother who would go on and sort of achieve the big things, and being quite shocked that I went on to sort of become a successful journalist. And so, you know, I think it did change his mind. When it was his birthday, I instituted a thing where we would go for lunch, and he thought this was ridiculous because he was, you know, not an emotional person. He was a workaholic. It was just not something, but he entertained it for me. And we would go for these lunches, and he'd tell me he thought it was ridiculous and why are we doing this. But so I think it was like looking across, you know, this sort of two generation gap of 60 years and sort of looking at each other intrigued by learning, I guess, through each other about a sort of different time. I mean, I think he probably thought, I don't know, I was over emotional and interested in nonsense things, and I thought his taste was maybe a bit old fashioned sometimes.
Yeah. But he did look after himself, and he lived into his 90s.
Well, he lived to 90, and I was thinking about that because we're in this age now, you know, everyone's obsessed, aren't they, with longevity and, you know, lactose, glutose-free, whatever, these special diets that you're supposed to eat and do all these. And you know what, I hate to say a bit, he really, like, smoked 60 a day. He drank, but he was very conscious of his weight.
God, I love him.
I know. I'm not, because that, you know, I think dangerously I thought I'm absolutely fine. I can get away with anything, which is not true. But I think it's that quite old fashioned diet that he sort of followed. You know, he would always weigh himself, have an idea if he'd got a bit of fat and stop eating. He walked everywhere. And he did go on this exercise bike sort of, obsessively. Mm. So I think that's a particular generation's attitude to health, isn't it? You know, on the one hand, he's the sort of chronic smoker. On the other hand, he thinks, as long as I got on my exercise bike. And he did. He lived very well. And he lived in the centre of Soho for a long time, so in the middle of London. I sort of wrote in my piece in a funny way, it meant that his lifestyle, we lived, you know, and went out together in a way he always had, because loads of places in Soho, like Bar Italia, had been there since the 50s. We'd go to the Brass Rail at Selfridges, which Salt Beef Place had been going to since the 60s. Ronnie Scott's had been there since the 60s. So it was funny that in a way he lived the same life. But I do think that walking around the city, and, you know, he was always, like I say, he was a workaholic. I think that mentally kept him very alive, because really up until his late 80s, he was very, you know, you couldn't tell he had aged, and he was always very playful and clever and engaged.
And were you mindful of the fact that, you know, he was closer to the end than the beginning, that you know, in the normal course of events, I suppose, you know, when parents are in their 50s, 60s, maybe they enter their seventh decade, then the children start to think, you know, in the back of their minds, this might happen. Were you very aware of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted to write now about how fun and all the strangeness and interest of having a much older dad, because the reality is I grew up not just very ashamed of him, but petrified he was going to die my whole life. You know, 62 when I was born, so I was 18 when he was turning 80. So he was always old, and he was always very old. You know, people were losing grandparents, and I was thinking, you know, God, that's how old he is. So all my life, I was worried I was going to get this phone call. I mean, it's sort of, he would have loved the fact that, you know, he actually carried on for ages until he was 90. But yeah, all my life I'd been worried that something would happen to him. You know, all my teenage years, I guess I was assuming, I understand now I'm 45, some of my friends are looking at their own parents now and worried about that. Mm. And I experienced all that really as a teenager, to be so worried something would happen to him. And yeah. I don't know if it's a blessing, but he got Alzheimer's, and it happened very quickly. So his decline happened very quickly. And really, it was almost within a year. So actually, he lived a sort of very, very full, healthy life. And then it all happened just sort of very fast at the end, sadly.
And was it after his death that you started to seek out siblings?
No, so I did grow up with my older brother. Mm. And yes, after he died, and I think I started, you know, becoming a journalist, and journalists are interested in stories. And I thought, gosh, I have this fascinating story. I mean, quite wild, like I say, like, you know, that I've got this connection, the 1890s, his parents coming over to England. So I researched more and more about him and my family. And that took me to follow his journey to South Africa, and amazingly met my older sister, who's 75. So
that's madder than having an old father.
Isn't it wild? And we had never met before.
Yeah.
I mean, so it took me till I was mid 40s to meet my sister for the first time. And it was quite wild, actually. And I learned loads more about him. I mean, it's just crazy, really. I was his third marriage, my mother was his third marriage, it turned out. And so he'd had this whole life with her that I didn't know about, you know, in South Africa. She was able to tell me about. And I tell you what, it's a very strange thing at 45 to meet your sister for the first time. I think we spent the first half hour just looking at each other, trying to work out, you know, do we look the same? Are we the same person? Like, it was so amazing, because we basically could tell each other about these two halves of his life. And what had been like when she grew up with him, what had been like when I grew up with him, because when he'd met my mother, he'd then moved to America, then England. So
yeah, did he? But you were aware he'd be married before, or did he keep that to himself as well?
I hadn't been aware of the first marriage.
Oh,
I had been aware I had this sister, and after he died, because she didn't reach out to me, I really thought, you know, I can't find her, but. Being the nosy journalist and the investigative journalist, I sort of put my mind to it one day and thought, I'm going to track her down. And I actually had to get all the way to Johannesburg and ask around. And I mean, it's a long story how I actually found her in the end. But I really had to be on the ground, basically, until I sort of ended up knocking on the door of this flat. And there she was. And she looks great. I mean, God, if you know, he lasted till 90. Mm. She had a lifetime of clubbing and being bad and smoking and drinking too. So she looks great. So, I mean, it's all very optimistic for me, I hope.
Yeah, I'm no doubt it is. Katie, such a fascinating story, really. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. That was Katie Glass there, feature writer with the London Times.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.